The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to a brand new series of The History Show. On this week's programme, The Irish Pub.
It's really interesting how Irish literature, you cannot avoid the pub.
Pubs were a place for seditious talk, for organising, for the public to come together in opposition to rule.
We'd explore the social and cultural history of the pub, its origins, its role in revolution, and its portrayal in drama, like Sean O'Casey's play, The Plough and the Stars.
The one thing in that play was bringing the Republican flag, which we worshipped at that time, into a public house. That was never done.
And coming up a little later, 98 years of the Academy Awards.
Really all it was about was making sure the right people were having dinner together. The very first Oscar ceremony was a dinner, and they had already told people who'd won, and they all just sat down and had dinner together.
Just ahead of Oscar night, we'd explore how the Oscars developed into the TV institution we know today. Well, it's great to be back for a new series of The History Show in a year that sees some very important centenaries in Irish history. In the coming weeks, we'll be previewing the release of the 1926 census by the National Archives. Of course, thanks to the 100-year rule, about a month from now, the public will finally be able to look at those detailed returns online. And we'll also be marking the 100th anniversary of Irish radio. But this evening, with the weekend that's in it, we're turning our attentions to perhaps the most enduring institution in Irish social life, the pub.
Our Lord bless Charlie Muff, the man who invented beer, 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 tiddly beer, beer, beer.
The Fury's bar, the Tansy's pub, the hole in the wall as well. Oh, one thing you can be sure of, it's Charlie's beer they sell.
We're going to explore now the past, present and future of the pub by delving into two recently published books. Books that look at how pubs evolved, how they've woven into everyday life, how the Irish pub became a worldwide cultural phenomenon, and how their portrayal in drama reflects their role in Irish society. I'm joined by three guests, historian Donal Fallon, author of The Dublin Pub, A Social and Cultural History, and also by the two editors of the book The Irish Pub, Invention and Reinvention. On the line from Hong Kong is Moon Yong Hong, assistant professor at the School of English at the University of Hong Kong, and in the RTE Sligo studio, Perry Scher, head of the School of Social Science and Humanities at Atlantic Technological University in Sligo. You're all very welcome indeed to the programme.
Good to be here.
Donal, first of all, your book, as you say in the introduction, is not a history of licensing laws and public house legislation. What you do is you look at individual pubs, the things that happened there, and stories that highlight their cultural importance. Is that right?
Absolutely. I wanted to present a history that was primarily a cultural and social history. And I suppose at first that would instantly recall things like Joyce's Ulysses. But historically, I've found that histories of the pub in Dublin have been very much rooted between the canals, in particular, you know, those city centre Victorian pubs that come to mind. And I wanted to go a little broader than that. So things like, you know, Michael Hartnett, the poet, his time in Inchicore and the centrality of McDowell's to the Inchicore haiku, or even things like in more recent times, how the pub, I think it remains arguably the defining third space of Irish public life, but it is losing ground to other things. So to look at the decline of suburban public houses, for example. So it's a broad overview of the social and cultural importance of the pub in the life of Dublin City and County.
Okay, well, we'll talk to you about some of the pubs that you have picked out a little bit later. But Perry, in your book, The Irish Pub, you take an interdisciplinary approach. You draw on anthropology, history, sociology, design, drama. And, you know, you're coming at it yourself as a sociologist. So talk to us, first of all, about this idea of pubs as a third place.
Yeah, well, the concept of the third place comes from an American sociologist called Ray Oldenburg. And he published a book with that title in 1999. And he was really drawing attention to places in society which are not work and not home, but provide a location for, I suppose, harking back almost to the coffee houses of the 18th century, a place for people to come together informally, without barriers, to discuss things, to enjoy themselves, to relax. So when I first came across that concept many years ago, I thought, yes, this is very much applicable to the pub in Ireland. Oldenburg did talk about English pubs, but he completely ignored pubs in Ireland, much to his loss. So I thought we could redress that a bit.
Now, in one of the early chapters, Elizabeth Malcolm's chapter, she develops modern pubs, or traces the development of modern pubs from their very earliest origins. And that's a story that can go back as far as the 15th century.
Yeah, in fact, Elizabeth even goes back to the Brehon laws and the traditions of hospitality that I suppose people are quite familiar with, the notion that, you know, there was an obligation to provide hospitality to travellers. Those Brehon laws didn't really connect directly with the laws that started coming in under English rule from about the 15th, 16th century on. And you referred earlier on to not being a history of licensing. And, you know, licensing laws have been very central to the development of pubs. The state, not surprisingly, has wanted to control drinking establishments. Every country has drinking establishments. And in Ireland, the English state wanted to control it, one, because it was a good source of revenue, and taxes on alcohol became quite significant in terms of income from Ireland, but also, of course, to control what went on in pubs. And, you know, they were quite clear in seeing that pubs were a place for seditious talk, for organising, for the public to come together in opposition to rules. So there was a very strong urge for the state to control pubs for those two reasons. And Elizabeth Malcolm, you know, traces that history through various pieces of legislation, some of which were very much paralleling what was happening in England and Wales at the times, and some which were more unique to Ireland. But there's a whole history of that going all the way up to even today. You know, that the government is tinkering with legislation around alcohol. So it's very much part of the state.
And Donald, that's something that you certainly have come across. You keep finding pubs at the centre, Dublin pubs, at the centre of revolutionary movements.
Absolutely. I mean, early on in the book, we have a history of drinking that really predates the public house as we know it. And as Perry touched on there, you're looking at the ale houses, the coffee houses, the taverns of an earlier time. But looking at the Society of United Irishmen in the 1790s and Theobald Wolfe Tone, I remember reading Tone's diaries for the first time and just being blown away by them. A great entry, July 14, 1792, generally drunk, broke my glass, thumping the table, home, God knows how or when, huzzah. But looking at how the Society of United Irishmen in both Belfast and Dublin, though my focus was Dublin, utilised these taverns as places of sedition, you know, as places where, before the movement was driven underground, where toasts could be raised to things like Tom Paine, to the spirit of the French mob and whatever else. Looking later at the Long Hall and its association with the Fenian movement, the Fenians, they'd learned the lessons in some ways of the United Irishmen. They tried to stop the infiltration of their movement by organising, as you know, into those tighter circles, into those cells. But still, pubs were important meeting places for them. Pubs were places where they came into contact with Irishmen in the ranks of the British Army. And the Long Hall itself is closed for a period after the Fenian Rebellion. It was such a feared centre of conspiracy. So by the time of the 1916 Rising, you're looking at a revolutionary cadre that more often than not are teetotalers. I mean, James Connolly and Pádraig Pearse are both teetotalers. I wonder how Pearse would feel about the fact not only a pub, but an early house is named in his honour in Dublin City today. But to follow the manner in which the pub had been the tavern in the case of the United Irishmen, the pub in the case of the Fenian movement, had both been central to organising revolutionary moments.
I also get a sense that with Michael Collins, that Michael Collins may have single-handedly reinstated the pub at the centre of revolutionary movements. Am I wrong there? I mean, he seems to have had most of his meetings in pubs.
One of the great legacies of the Irish Revolution is the Bureau of Military History, of course, and I know you've discussed that on the programme before, but that the Bureau gives us the ability to search these thousands of statements by key words, and snugs come up time and time again in a Dublin context. Snugs were important places where you know, revolutionary plans could be hatched. We know, for example, the Signal House, as it appears in Ulysses, better known as Cleary's Pub today, by Amiens Street Bridge, that has a very strong documented primary source history in the Irish Revolution. Other pubs like Philip Shanahan's Pub, which, believe it or not, was in the heart of Monto. It's an extraordinary thing to imagine, but you know, Monto was a place where soldiers were constantly coming and going. And we know that firearms and papers would be left in Philip Shanahan's Pub in the Monto. The Palace on Fleet Street is another one that comes to mind. And for Willie Ahern, I know, it was a source of great pride that on the wall of the palace for many years was that wanted poster, that famous wanted poster for Dan Breen, you know, the Tipperary associations of that pub and the revolution were so real.
Moon Young, you look at the Irish pub through the lens of drama, Irish drama specifically. Tell us first of all, though, about your own background and how you became interested in the subject of Irish pubs. As we would say in Ireland, 'tis far from Irish pubs you were reared.
Yeah, well, so I studied Irish literature. I majored in English literature and we studied English drama, but Beckett was on the syllabus. So actually my entry point into Irish literature is Beckett. But equally, I was fascinated with, you know, the parallels between Irish literature and Irish history, you know, the idea of being colonized by the neighbors, neighboring countries, this idea of border and division. So I was fascinated with the parallels between Ireland and Korea. So I'm originally from Korea. I guess that's something I should tell you. It's really interesting how Irish literature, you cannot avoid the pub. The pub is where Irish writers gather. So McDade's, for instance, is where Brendan Behan would have frequented. But I was interested particularly in the plays that are set in the pubs. So my contribution is kind of looking at early 20th century plays up till now, where the setting is the pub, and how playwrights would use the pub culture as a source of creating their dramatic form. So this whole idea of storytelling, of sharing monologues and dialogues and banter, that sort of thing is then used to create their drama. So I guess that's my angle.
Yeah, you had a particular interest in Tom Murphy, in the playwright Tom Murphy, who was frequently himself to be found in the 108 in Rathgar. What did you find pub-related when you researched him?
Yeah, so one of the iconic pub play of Tom Murphy is called Conversations on a Homecoming. It's produced in 1985, but it's set around the time John F. Kennedy was elected as president, and then the assassination of JFK. The pub in the setting is called the White House. It's named after the owner, who looks like John F. Kennedy. It's about the aspiring actor Michael, who goes to the United States and then returns home in Galway in the west of Ireland, and the kind of conversation that they have. The pub becomes a kind of symbol of Ireland. It's like the hope. It's a cultural cradle. But then with the assassination kind of comes the disillusionment of Ireland and Irish identity and what it represents. So that's one play. There are actually a few, but yeah, that would be the main one.
Now, Donal, both you and Moon Young write about the two most controversial plays in the early life of the Abbey Theatre. J.M. Singh's The Playboy of the Western World in 1907 and Sean O'Casey's The Plough and the Stars in 1926. Moon Young, perhaps we'll talk a little bit about the Playboy in a few minutes. But Donal, remind us why, first of all, The Plough, now celebrating 100 years with a new Abbey production, caused such an uproar, and why the pub setting mattered so much in that uproar, in that chaos.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's important to make the point that not all writers spent all of their time in public houses. You know, and John McGahern had that line about McDade's. The McDade's world is such a jungle, it's impossible. He didn't want to be around writers and pubs. And Sean O'Casey, likewise. I mean, O'Casey was a teetotaler. O'Casey would have been very much a Larkinite in his worldview, and the pubs were one of the things Jim Larkin had in his sights. You know, Larkin stopped the practice of Dublin dockers being paid in public houses, for example, and that great line that the workers of Dublin would live to see grass grow over the Guinness Brewery never came to fruition. But I think for O'Casey, he was interested in the humour of the Dublin workers in the public house, even if it wasn't the place he frequented himself. And I think that moment in The Plough and the Stars, where we have a scene where Rosie Redmond's character is a prostitute. Now, remember, the Munto was within spitting distance of the Abbey and had only closed the previous year. But when a character delivers a line like, "The freedom those men are fighting for is freedom not worth winning in a raffle," that was always going to cause trouble in the aisles. But I think it might equally have been the presence of the tricolour and the Starry Plough, the flag of the Citizen Army, appearing in a public house that caused so much anger in the aisles that day. And we often think about censorship in Ireland as something that's done by
by conservative forces, by, you know, parish priests denouncing literature from the pulpit. But this was Hannah Sheehy Skeffington. This was Frank Ryan. This was very much the left of the Republican movement, Maud Gonne and others. And for me, I think the presence of the national flag in the public house, above everything else, is what caused so much anger towards O'Casey and the plough.
Okay, we're going to get confirmation of that. It's, as I said, it's 100 years since the plough and the stars caused a riot at the Abbey Theatre. We're going to hear from Sheila Humphreys, the Irish Republican and a member of Cumann na Mban, so obviously very much, as Donald was saying, on the left. She is recalling why, as far as she was concerned, the riot took place at a performance of O'Casey's The Plough and the Stars in 1926. This is from a 1984 episode of the RTE radio programme Women Today.
The one thing in that play was bringing the Republican flag unfurled into the public house. That was never done. And when you bring a flag like that, for, you know, floating, it's always a sign of delight and victory and everything. And these Republicans would not bring that into a public house.
Was that your main objection?
That was the main objection. The main objection. They said it was the prostitute. It wasn't. We'd have easily put up with her. That was part of life. But it certainly was not part of life to bring an unfurled Republican flag, which we worshipped at that time, into a public house.
And that was the voice there of Sheila Humphreys. Moon Young, she's asserting that it was not the character of Rosie Redmond, a prostitute, that caused the uproar, but rather the presence of a Republican flag in a public house. Do you think that's only a partial truth?
Yeah, I think it's a cumulative, right? It's that juxtaposition. So actually what happens in Act Two is that, you know, Rosie is making jeering remarks how the nationalist holy mood is hurting her business, while Patrick Pearse's voice, it's outside. We hear, you know, bloodshed and sacrifice. So it's that kind of juxtaposition. And the pub was associated with degeneracy. So there's that element of iconography being desecrated. And I must also say 1926 is, you know, 10 years just after the Easter Rising. So I think timing-wise, it's just fresh enough to be remembered, but also it's hallowed in memory. You know, it had gained a certain status, historical weight. So yeah, the flag carrying that kind of, it's an icon, it's a potent icon, should be commemorated, right? It shouldn't be desecrated. So I think there are multiple levels to that. And at the time of the nationalist movement, it requires a kind of binary thinking. It has to be, you know, good or evil, sacred or profane. So these playwrights, including O'Casey, would kind of confound certain categories. And I think that would have contributed to the riot. And people in that audience, it wasn't just Sheila Humphrey, you know, Fiona Plunkett, sister of Joseph Plunkett, and Margaret Pearse. We also have Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, her husband, Francis Sheehy Skeffington. So you can see why these women whose, you know, family members were involved in the rising would have taken offence.
Let's go back 19 years to 1907 and the Playboy of the Western world, placed in a pub. The entire, or almost every scene takes place in a pub in a shebeen, and the outrage that caused in Dublin. What was that about? Was it about the setting? Was it about the way people were behaving in the pubs? What caused the upset of the audience back in 1907?
Yeah, so there are multiple interpretations. The famous story is that Lady Gregory sends a telegram to Yeats saying the audience broke up in disorder at the word shift. And shift refers to undergarments, you know, underwear. And actually this word is used twice before in Act Two, but in that case, it's kind of just an item of laundry or it's something to be mended. Whereas in Act Three, when the word shifts mentioned, it's when Christie, you know, Widow Quinn is trying to seduce Christie, and he says, "It's Pegeen I'm seeking only. What I care if you brought me a drift of chosen females standing in their shifts itself, maybe from this place to the Eastern world." So in this case, the shifts appear on women's bodies. So this idea of a woman being so central to nationalist iconography again, should be desexualized. But, you know, this idea of a group of women standing in their shifts would have been scandalous. And people often think, oh, is it the patricide? Is it because Christie kills his father? That's kind of objectionable. But it's more the fact that these women are attracted to a guy who killed his father. I think that was even more problematic. And yeah, I think the fact that Singh was also Protestant might have added to the offence. Yeah.
Okay, so we won't blame the pub for that one. But I mean, one thing that you've noticed is the contrast between the reaction in Dublin and the reaction in the West of Ireland. In the West of Ireland, nobody gave a toss.
Yeah, so it's interesting when it was performed in the West of Ireland, people were bored rather than annoyed and would say, we see that type of carry-on all the time. Like, but it's interesting how once the fervor of the protest for Playboy kind of settled in, people were kind of having fun with the play as well. You know, they would react by inserting a line, you know, so when the police were involved to supervise the show, people say, oh, why don't you go arrest Christie? He just killed his father. You know, there's a lot of audience reaction where the theater itself almost becomes like a pub space. You know, people are actively talking and reacting to the show.
Moving away from drama, Perry, to a watering hole that's, I have to say, would not never have occurred to me. You've looked into the history of, wait for it, Dublin Airport as a destination drinking spot. And apparently it was that in the 1950s.
Indeed it was. Yeah, I mean, this came to me. I was flying somewhere and ended up in the what's called unimaginatively, I think, the Guinness Bar in Terminal 1 in Dublin Airport. And airports, sociologists and anthropologists have always seen airports as nun spaces or as liminal spaces. You know, they don't really belong anywhere. People flow through them. They have no identity. You know, they're not places you want to be. And my experience in Dublin Airport was that the pub in Dublin Airport, if you like, functioned very well as a pub. And I'm sure lots of listeners have been through the airport. And, you know, I think technically speaking, drinking can start at 4:30 a.m., which is unusual in Ireland. But the notion that you can have this pub in a nun space and you're recreating community and you're recreating, you know, national identity, if you like, within a pub struck me. And then it made me think back to the history of Dublin Airport. And of course, the original Dublin Airport building is still there, ensconced in the middle of all the modern buildings, you know, the remarkable original building of Dublin Airport. And that had within it a very posh restaurant and cocktail bar back in the 1950s. And people would actually go out to the airport. They wouldn't necessarily be going anywhere because it was incredibly expensive to fly anywhere in those days. So most people would never experience being on a plane. But they would go out there and they would watch the planes coming and going from the restaurant or from the cocktail bar. And then on New Year's Eve, it was the place to be. They would have a New Year's Eve ball and people would go out there in their finest to the airport.
And they would dress up.
They would indeed, yeah, as you would if you were going to a cocktail, I suppose, a cocktail evening or, you know, a posh dinner. I mean, there was a French menu. It was as far as I know, it was run by the people who ran Jammet's restaurant in Dublin, which, of course, was the most celebrated restaurant in Dublin. Mm. And it was certainly a social cachet to be out at the airport. I presume some of them were flying onto places, but I think the vast majority just went there to see the airplanes and to be seen, of course.
OK, to be seen. Interesting. So I segued, Donald, because some people went to pubs and didn't want to be seen. And I think you mentioned already, there's a section in your book on snugs and mirrors, which looks at the aesthetics and the layout of pubs.
Yeah, that's such a fascinating dimension of the tale, isn't it? And how the physicality of the pub has shifted and evolved through time. One thing we're seeing in more recent times is the emergence of what we might call almost fake old pubs. And the definition of what a snug is, to me, seems to have broadened completely. I mean, I would argue a snug has to have a number of, you know, key characteristics about it to earn the title. One is it needs a direct communication with the bar staff. That's normally in the form of a small window or a hatch. And two, it needs you need the ability to close the snug off. You need that hatch on the inside. So that was what gave them that sense of privacy. And in popular memory now, they're recalled as a place where, for example, women could be served on the premises. I think that's over-egged a little bit. I think there were public houses where women were part of the mix much earlier than we might expect. There's accounts of pubs in the market areas of Dublin in the 1920s and 30s where female market traders, Shawleys, Boer War veterans and the like were all part of the clientele. So I don't think necessarily snogs existed for women to be on a premises in secret. I think there were all kinds of people who wanted to go about their business in private, in a pub, and that was their logic. The mirrors refers to the advertising mirrors. Beautiful things, like fine works of craftsmanship for brands like DWD, whiskey, great big distillers in their days that have faded into historical memory, but they still exist. And the Palace on Fleet Street, you'll see just a beautiful array of these mirrors for breweries and distilleries of yesterday. The craftsmanship that went into something like that, whereas advertising today generally happens on our mobile phones or on the side of a playing pitch. But at that time, you were advertising the product in the bar. And they're just a really beautiful surviving part of the landscape of Dublin pubs. J&K Walsh's, for example, down in Waterford City, has a beautiful advertising mirror for Daniel O'Connell Ale, which is just transporting you back into the politics of the 19th century when you look at it.
And they still come up for sale at auctions around the country and fetch quite a lot of money. Perry, you also have a chapter on Irish pubs and gender. And answer me this, why were so many pubs in Cork run by women?
It was to do with the way in which the drink industry was organised in Cork. And again, listeners may be aware that in England and Wales, we have what's called tight houses, or until recently, tight houses, where breweries owned pubs, and some breweries would own thousands of pubs. And the person that worked in the pub then was the landlord, was a tenant of the pub, of the brewery. That model also applied in Cork with both Beamish's and Murphy's. They both had tied pubs, and the vast majority of pubs in Cork were tied pubs. And Tom Spalding, who's the contributor who talks about pubs in Cork, goes into great detail about this. So it was very unusual in Ireland to have this tied relationship. And what it meant was that it was a great opportunity for women to be employed as pub managers. And so the husband, as was, you know, could be working in another industry, manufacturing industry or in small business, and then the wife could run the pub, and the family indeed could live above the pub in premises provided by the brewery. So it was a great setup, you know, to support families working in pubs.
And when, Perry, did the Irish pub become a global product?
Well, the apocryphal story, whether it's an apocryphal story or not, I don't know, was that it was during Italia 90 when Guinness executives in Milan noted the huge popularity of an Irish pub in Milan and how it outperformed and outprofited all the indigenous pubs. And then a relationship grew up between a design company and Diageo, that owned Guinness's, the Irish pub company, who actually got into the business of designing pubs, Irish pubs. They had a number of standard designs like the cottage or the brewery or the Victorian pub, and they would literally be put into containers and exported across the world. So it was a remarkably successful business, and it's interesting that the number of pubs in Ireland is around about 7,000, 6,000 to 7,000, and the number of Irish pubs across the world is at least 7,000.
I suppose, Donald, final question. Have we long since seen the halcyon days of the Irish pub, other than, you know, in Australia or Kazakhstan or Italy or Paris or wherever? Is the Irish public house in terminal decline, do you think?
Well, that reference to Italia 90 reminds me of the great Con Houlihan's observation when he said, I missed Italia 90. I was in Italy at the time. It felt like something that had to be experienced in an Irish pub. Definitely our relationship with the public house is shifting and evolving all the time. For example, pubs like Early Houses have pretty much disappeared. There's only three in Dublin city centre now to open their doors at 7 o'clock in the morning. So that clearly is the kind of pub that no longer has its place in society as we see it. But other pubs are thriving and doing well. Sean O'Casey, as a teetotaler, may not have been too happy that there was a pub named in his honour beside the Abbey, but it's now Piper's Corner, and it's thriving as a traditional music pub. It's thriving as a pop-up Gaeltacht in the city centre. So you're seeing film screenings in pubs, you're seeing table quiz nights, you're seeing, which I know for some people that's their idea of hell, food in public houses, while it's divisive too, has changed the landscape completely. And just the other day, I was in the American Bar in Sailor Town in Belfast. That was once a Dockers Early House, and now it's doing a tapas menu. So you know, this is what happens.
How the mighty have fallen.
We may end up with different kinds of pubs, and perhaps, you know, Brendan Behan might not recognise some of the pubs of Dublin today to what he knew in his time. But I think in time, a pub will find its groove.
Well, if you're heading to the pub this bank holiday weekend, consider it field work for a book that you might write. Just try not to do too much research while you're at it. We've been talking about the past, the present and the future of the Irish pub and some of the ideas explored in two recent publications. The Dublin Pub, A Social and Cultural History by Donal Fallon. Also, The Irish Pub, Invention and Reinvention, edited by Moon Young Hong and Perry Scher. Thank you all very much indeed for joining us.
Our Lord bless Charlie Muff, the man who invented beer, 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 tiddly beer, beer, beer.
The Fury's bar, the Tansy's pub, the hole in the wall as well. Oh, one thing you can be sure of, it's Charlie's beer they sell. So come on, all me lucky lads, 11 o'clock.
After the break, I'll be joined by Harvey O'Brien to talk about the history of the Academy Awards. Stay with us. Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 1.
And now as the house lights darken, the orchestra descends into the pit. And slowly the curtain rises to disclose a stunning stage setting dominated by a huge replica of the hero of the evening, the Academy Oscar. And just in front of it, a whole table full of those coveted awards.
Tonight, in case you didn't know it, is Oscar night. The 98th edition of the annual Academy Awards, hosted by Conan O'Brien, takes place this evening at the Dolby Theatre in Los Angeles. Tonight's ceremony is historic in a number of ways. It sees the debut of a brand new award, Achievement in Casting, which is the first new category in decades. Also, thanks in part to that new category, the film Sinners has smashed the record for the number of nominations with 16. To talk about all of this and to explore how the Oscars developed into the TV institution we know today, 4.5 hours long, the ceremonies tend to be, I'm joined now in studio by Dr. Harvey O'Brien of University College Dublin. You're very welcome back to the History Show, Harvey.
Thank you very much.
Take us right back to the beginning. Was it the silent era? Is that when they started?
Let's take you back to even before the beginning, and let's talk about how an industry rewards itself for its achievements, because that's really the background to the Oscar. Who gets to give the awards and the kind of clash between industry and populism? Because the earliest kind of film awards in the 20th century were the photoplay awards, and that was voted on by readers of the magazine. And the idea there was it was whatever was popular. They allowed the public to nominate films that they thought they really liked and explain why, basically. And a gold medallion was given out to the winners. The purpose of it was, as the statement went at the time, because people were getting medals for war and things like that. Well, why shouldn't people get medals for arts? And so from 1920, when they announced it, to 1921 was the first year they gave them out. These were public-driven awards, in which people who just simply liked films wanted to see their films win an award. In conjunction with that, you have the film industry itself. How does it organize itself? How does it kind of consider itself in the early 20th century? Part of it is to do with the fact that film is a business. In 1915, there was a very famous legal case, Mutual versus Ohio. And basically, the American Supreme Court ruled that the film business was a business, and therefore, it wasn't protected under the First Amendment in free speech, so that it had to obey authority, and they started to push for a national censorship kind of organization.
This is the Hays Code.
Yeah, this is before the Hays Code even, but it led to the Hays Code. What the distinction is that the first kind of board of review was set up in 1915, and that was a state-run thing. And then the Hays Code was because the producers themselves, and this is my point, those who made the film said, no, we don't need you to regulate us. We'll do it ourselves. So the Hays Code came out of the MPPDA, later known as the MPAA, which was self-regulation, Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America. And they said, no, well, we will control the kind of films that we make. We will ensure quality control. You don't need to organize it. You don't need to censor us. And this came with the notorious Hays Code, where, taking the Bible as his example, he said, well, this should be in a film, this shouldn't be in a film, this should be in a film. But it was the industry regulating itself. Mm. So the Oscars...
Or the industry patting itself.
Is the industry recognizing itself, right? And they take over from the Photoplay Awards as the premier kind of zone in which people would actually give these kinds of awards, because that is run by the industry. The story goes that the beginnings of the Oscars is with Louis B. Mayer.
and that really what Louis Bumaire was trying to do was to control the unions. That what he wanted to do was to make sure that this organized industry recognized peer achievements through proper channels. And those proper channels were the five so-called branches of the academy, which is the writers, the directors, producers, technicians, and actors. So these were the branches, right? And they're the five gaps on the reel that's on the statue. They represent the five branches. Each of those branch had strong lobby groups and people who were organized and people who represented them. And so therefore, they could talk peer-to-peer with people like Louis B. Mayer. So Mayer pushed for the establishment of this independent organization, which would come to be known as the American Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And he invited Douglas Fairbanks to become the first president, because Fairbanks, biggest movie star in the world from the previous generation. And so that gave that sort of stamp of authority to what they were doing. This is art. This is serious. And yet at the same time, really all it was about was making sure the right people were having dinner together. Because that's exactly what it was. The very first Oscar ceremony was a dinner.
Yeah.
And they had already told people who'd won, and they all just sat down and had dinner together.
And when did it begin to capture the imagination? I suppose, was this when it was televised, or was it even before that?
It went on radio in 1930, so that was a significant step forward. Again, it's to do with the media. Think about Photoplay, I said, was the beginnings of awards. That was a published magazine. So by the time you get to the 1930s, people are interested in modern media. And this is what we see in continuity today, with the Oscars now being streamed on Hulu and pulling in a bigger audience than they have in many, many years, because that's where the audience is. So radio was where the audience was in 1930, and people would tune in to hear the Oscar ceremony. Again, the same thing. Listen to, oh, who's there? There's Clark Gable. There's whatever it is. All of these people that are there. Then in 1933, they actually didn't have a ceremony because they wanted to realign the eligibility criteria so that the year the film was released and the year the Oscars were given out would make sense. Because prior to that, people were basically nominating the films they liked from whatever it was. The first Oscars, which was 1929, there were films from 1925 that were in the nomination because people just said, oh, I like that one. Off it went. In 1953, then they went to television. So again, think about it. Newspapers, radio, television. Mm. And television was the biggest thing on the planet. So therefore, its popularity soared, broadcast first on NBC TV. And then once you get to the 1960s, it starts to get shown internationally through satellite broadcasting. Again, technology reaching the largest groups of people. So all the time it was to do with keeping pace with technology, where people were watching things and how they were watching them. So the streaming era has been a challenge for the film industry on the whole, but the Oscars has essentially kept pace with it by now becoming a streaming phenomenon.
And relatively few Irish winners in the early years until we get really to the 21st century, I suppose.
There are a number. It's just that people, you may not remember them or even know the names. It's a piece of trivia, but it is true that the Oscar itself was designed by an Irishman.
Cedric Gibbons.
And he came up with the design, and then it was manufactured by someone who actually made it work. But he himself was nominated numerous times and won throughout the 1920s, the 1930s, right up to the 1950s. So he was a recognized figure within the Academy, a very big character at the time. And speaking of characters, there's Barry Fitzgerald. Barry Fitzgerald has made Oscar history for a very specific reason. One of the stories is, of course, that he knocked the head off his Oscar with a golf swing.
In fairness, they were made of plaster.
They were made of plaster at that time. They were initially not made of plaster, and then they ran out of materials and they made them of plaster. And they're not. But he did knock the head off his Oscar. But why he was historically important is in 1944, when he won his Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for Going My Way, he was also nominated for Best Actor for the same role in the same film. So this was again to do with eligibility. You see, this is the point. The Oscars is the rule book. Here's what is or is not this type of thing. And the rule book at the time didn't, you know, prevent that. So people nominated him and he got in both categories. Immediately afterwards, they changed it. So that can't happen now. You can't have the same person nominated for the same role in two different categories. But he was. So that was a huge history-making moment for Barry Fitzgerald to announce to the world.
Now, I suppose knocking the head off your plaster Oscar is not particularly controversial, but there have been a number of controversies over the years, haven't there?
Yeah, I mean, the Oscars always draws controversy because at best, the Oscar is a litmus test for what the industry thinks of itself and how the public engages with it. To go back to that point, it's really that interface between production and reception. And so as a result, sometimes people are unhappy that the public will kind of go, well, hang on, the thing I liked didn't win. And that brings us right back to the idea that once upon a time, the people determined what the win was, whereas instead it's the industry that votes on it. And the nature of the people who vote on it
has changed over time, and enormously in the last couple of years, very much in response to specific controversies. There was the Oscars So White incident, in which a group of people began to say, hang on a minute, we haven't like seen a black person nominated for an award in several years. What the hell is going on? And in response to that, they began to introduce diversity in the process. You had to actually have a certain percentage of mixed roles in the film. You had to have not only that, creatives, actors and internships promoting the industry to change its character. They also hugely increased the membership from 5,000 to 11,000. So again, it becomes a question of who gets to vote. So the controversies over time have often centered on, well, what got voted in and why didn't my film get it? Probably the most famous example is Shakespeare in Love in 1999, which Harvey Weinstein put in a huge publicity campaign for and really pushed, and it paid off and it won loads of Oscars. And everybody kind of goes, what was that film again? But if I said to you, oh, Saving Private Ryan, you go, oh, I know what that is. Those two films faced off. The more worthy film from the traditional point of view that we would have thought would be the one that would win did not win because the other one had a better campaign. There were also micro controversies over time. The famous refusal of the Oscar by George C. Scott and by Marlon Brando. George C. Scott's was on the basis that he felt it was unfair to compare actors to other actors. He thought it was pointless and didn't want to have anything to do with it. Marlon Brando famously sent a Native American activist onto the stage to make a speech about the treatment of Native Americans on screen and refused the Oscar. And these became kind of talking points about what it was. There are others. Crash, when Crash won the Oscar. This was an LA movie, a very LA type movie about the lives of wealthy individuals in Los Angeles and how a car crash brings them all together, yeah. Diverse people, etc. There was, you know, it was a portmanteau film with lots of different characters. Very much an actor's movie, which is probably why it won. The fact is that the people who vote on the whole are actors, that the acting categories are the largest sort of segment of it now. And especially since they separated out all of the others, the technical awards, that was the original Oscar category. It was for technical achievement. And then they actually established a separate strand for technical Oscars in the 1930s. And that now is a whole thing in and of itself. The technical Oscars are like very technical. I mean, if you actually look at the awards, they're for kind of, you know, micro changes to sound recording technologies or all kinds of stuff. But it is the American Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and the people involved in it are highly skilled technicians.
And it is the people involved in specific activities who specifically vote in
exactly.
The narrow categories.
In the
so
narrow
an actor
categories.
Doesn't vote for Best Cinematographer, for example.
No, but they all vote for Best Picture. And that's why you get that skewing, because this huge kind of quantity of actors, anyone who's ever been nominated or won, and if you think about the number of them that there are, they vastly outnumber the other side. And so you get these odd decisions. And I think Crash was the basis of that. I think it was an actor's movie. And people went, what? Are you out of your mind? Why is this movie winning Best Picture?
The growth then of the categories, I mean, we refer to it to some extent, to the inclusion tonight of casting. Now, I'm going to be personal. That seems to me to be utterly daft when, for example, there is no Oscar for stunt persons. Why is that?
Yeah, it's complicated. It's to do with, again, representation, with unions and with eligibility criteria. You need to have a strong lobby for whatever your category is in order to get entered into the Oscars. And although there has been a certain amount of lobbying for stunt people over time, they don't have a kind of branch of the Academy in that traditional sense of, you know, they're not actors, they're not producers, they're not technicians. What are they exactly? How do they argue their case? How do they present it? Also, you have to bear in mind that, as we know, tragically, you know, that can be the site of various problems to do with risk and indeed death, as we saw quite recently. And you can understand that if somebody, for example, who was working, you know, on armaments on a film we won't mention, you know, suddenly got nominated for an award for that. Well, how would you then kind of what is your responsibility in that situation? And it's a dangerous profession. So you can see that they would be a little edgy on it. Casting, on the other hand, well, casting is how people find work. Casting, as I said to you, is what actors rely on at the end of the day. And choosing the right people for the right roles is a skill. And they're also very much industry insiders. Everybody knows the casting people.
And in terms of the snobbery that we associate with the films that are nominated and the films that win, they always seem to be very, very worthy rather than necessarily the most popular films of the year. Where does Sinners fit into all of that? Because it seems to have almost abruptly brought an end to that phenomenon.
It's interesting. Again, when you go back into it, the very first Oscars in 1929 had two separate categories for drama and comedy, which is something that the Globes, the Golden Globes, still do. Recognizing that these are two different strands of filmmaking that do two different things. And that was partly in 1929 because comedy had been so huge all through the silent era. And remember that Charlie Chaplin was given a special Oscar in recognition for his work back then. And it was only later he got an honorary Oscar for contribution to the cinema overall. And so by kind of saying, well, this kind of film is achieving this effect and this effect we deem very worthy, this film is achieving this effect we don't, they're creating a hierarchy for audiences to respond to. And again, there have been responses to that over time, like increasing the number of films that are nominated for Best Picture. Instead of at 5, it goes up to 10. Animation being introduced as a category unto itself a number of years ago. Now, Sinners is an interesting case in point because, well, traditionally, of course, you'd say it's a horror film. And it is a horror film. But again, if you've seen it, you spend about an hour kind of wondering where the vampires are, if that's what you think you're coming to see. What you're seeing is a dramatic film about the South, about racism, about crime, about family. And it's really, you know, very powerful. And then the vampires come and it adds a whole layer to it. So to call it a horror film in a way that says that horror is somehow not serious is to misunderstand what the cinema can be. I mean, a film like The Exorcist is an incredibly powerful, brilliant piece of filmmaking in and of itself, even on a technical level. So that got award nominations. There is an assumption that the Academy is against horror. Yes and no. Silence of the Lambs may or may not be a horror film, but Silence of the Lambs is one of the few films to win the Big Five. The Big Five is the great prize at the Oscars, winning Best Actor, Actress, Screenplay, Directing, and Best Picture. And Silence of the Lambs did it. Again, really, it's more of a thriller, but at the same time, there are people, including my wife, who won't watch that movie. So, you know, I think...
Doesn't it like fava beans. Yeah,
yeah, that's actually the real problem. But yeah, so it can be that certain films lend themselves more obviously to being taken seriously by the voters. They'll look at it and go, oh, this is something I need to pay attention to. And Sinners makes you pay attention to it from the opening all the way through.
Okay, well, they will be going crazy 2 years from now because it'll be the 100th edition of the annual Academy Awards. And, you know, that will be history and historic and history making. But tonight, sorry to be parochial about it, but fingers crossed for Jessie Buckley, up Kerry.
I'm up for it, yeah.
Hopefully, she will make it. She richly deserves to. But Harvey, thank you very much indeed. Dr. Harvey O'Brien of UCD with 98 years of the Academy Awards.
This winds up our Academy Awards show. This is Ken Carpenter saying goodnight and hoping we'll see you again next year on Oscar night. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
That's all we've time for in this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Liam Mullen and Harry Booklis on sound, and our researcher, Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye, and thanks for listening.